A pleasure to introduce our first speaker. Steve West is known by a number of you, of course, because he's been a speaker here before. Steve is a good friend and a colleague for a number of years. He has just taken on a new ministry of a church. He has been at Madoc Baptist Church for the last 8 years and will be starting in 2 weeks at his new ministry at Crestwick Baptist Church in Guelph, Ontario. And so we rejoice that Steve is here. He's going to come in his two sessions this afternoon, revisiting free will. So Steve, please come.
Well, it is a pleasure to be back with you this year. The next two sessions, revisiting free will or free will revisited, I just want to put a bit of a disclaimer over it. That is, this is a new area of study for me. It's something that I've been trying to analyze and study for the last number of months. But this is merely talking out loud. This is thinking out loud. This is trying to work through some fairly difficult material for myself. Anyway, it is likely not difficult for you, and that's wonderful. It's a little bit difficult for me, and one of the things I understand the Bunyan Conference to be about is the opportunity to begin to work through some things together. Things that we may not have the final word for just yet, things that we might not have even hard and steadfast conclusions about, but things that we're beginning to think about, things that we're interested in pursuing. So please don't feel any embarrassment for your sake. You may be embarrassed for my sake as I'm beginning to go through this, but don't feel embarrassed about offering criticisms or corrections in terms not only of analysis or conclusion, but even in terms of description. If I get some of the positions wrong, please feel free to correct. Isaiah 46:8 says, "Remember this, fix it in mind, take it to heart, you rebels. Remember the former things, those of long ago. I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me. I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times what is still to come. I say my purpose will stand, and I will do all that I please. My purpose will stand, I will do all that I please." When you begin to study the issue of free will and determinism, one of the things that you will find if you engage in it at any depth whatsoever is that there is an immense quantity of literature. There are writers in almost every academic field who are addressing issues in terms of deterministic processes. Not only, though, is there a tremendous quantity of literature, there's also a tremendous qualitative aspect to the literature. That is, much of it is highly specialized. Much of it's highly technical. So you're confronted with the twin challenges of having just an immense breadth of literature to canvas, but also an inordinate depth, too, in a way which you don't often get combined in one particular topic. So what I want to do for our sessions this afternoon is I want to just, in a preliminary sense, sketch out or rough in a few of the important issues that are in play in these discussions, just to present a nest or a cluster of some of the sticking points that are important. My goal is not to be primarily exegetical. In fact, I'm making an assumption. You can't come close to covering everything. So I'm making an assumption which I think is fair, and that is that in these discussions, this group is likely most familiar with the exegesis and scriptural exposition that lies behind debates between Calvinists and Arminians. And so I'm not going to be going through biblical texts. I assume that that's an area in which you are more familiar. So I'm not going to be primarily exegetical. What I want to do is I want to sketch in a little bit philosophically some of the analyses of concepts. What do we mean when we begin to talk about determinism and freedom? What's required for there to actually be something that allows us to be responsible? And in fact, one of the things that I've been finding is that in a lot of discussions in the church, there are an awful lot of highly debatable and heavily freighted philosophical assumptions that are just assumed and brought over wholesale into the theological discussion about the character of God, not least in terms of soteriology. And so one of the things that we want to do is we want to be able to certainly engage at the exegetical level. That's primary, and that's the most important thing, of course. But we also want to be able to see if the concepts that are coming out of the exegesis or that are being assumed before the exegesis are cogent. We want to make sure that the positions we're discussing are even coherent. They're even logically possible. Just one brief note of warning, more for myself, something that I warned myself about and that I took comfort in many steps along the way, is that this is also a study which demands humility. It demands prayer and a humble spirit. Not least because people who literally, in terms of IQ and intellect and study, were geniuses in the history of the church, some of God's choicest intellectual servants, have wrestled with these issues and found them difficult and baffling. That gives me great hope. But it also reminds me that I don't want to be too quick or too arrogant to think of myself more highly than I ought and just write off a lot of people who have thought through these things with great intellectual power over a tremendous number of years. So there are geniuses in theological church history. There are geniuses in philosophical history, the history of Western thought, who have wrestled through these particular issues. Some of our finest theologians and philosophers today, that is, our contemporaries, are still wrestling with these things. And beyond the human caliber, we must never forget that we are trying to talk about a being who is infinite and transcendent in glory and essence and character and knowledge and wisdom. All of his paths are beyond tracing out. He is in the best sense incomprehensible. He is literally, for any finite being, unfathomable. We can never exhaustively comprehend him. Only God can exhaustively comprehend himself. And so then we begin to struggle to put human analogies, and this is one of the things that we can't help but do, but it's very dangerous, can be very misleading. When we begin to look at what's required for responsibility, and what it means to be determined or coerced or compelled, all of our analogies and illustrations are drawn from the human horizontal world. Then we start saying, well, if we acted this way towards each other, then we would undercut someone else's freedom. And then we sort of assume that God only has the capabilities and capacities that we have. And that's very dangerous. God is not just like us, but a little bit bigger. He is qualitatively different. He is transcendent. We want to bear that in mind, and we want to be humble enough to realize that there are times when, not just because of sin, but even because of our finite nature, we simply run to the end of what a human being can comprehend in terms of the character and way and being of God. However, we do want to do our best to move along as well as we can. Right, we don't just want to sort of fall back into some sort of mysticism where we don't know anything about God. You know, God has revealed himself. He can be known truly, even if not comprehensively or exhaustively. And so he calls us to study. He calls us to think. He calls us to pray. He calls us to correct each other and to help each other grow in sharpening our understanding of him. Well, first then, some introductory positions about free will. You, of course, are familiar, doubtlessly, with the theological distinction between Calvinism and Arminianism. I would urge you, this is just as a practical caution, you might not want to identify yourself as a Calvinist or as an Arminian until you know what the person you're talking to means by those terms themselves. There are a lot of people who have explained to me what they think Calvinists believe, and it's nothing at all what I believe. And so I don't want to give people the impression that I hold to a whole lot of doctrines which I would repudiate with equal force that they do, and that I would find just as repulsive and unbiblical as they do. So we want to be very careful. If people understand what Calvinism is, I'm not ashamed to take that label to myself, but I'm also a little bit worried that sometimes what I mean by the doctrines of grace, what I mean by Reformed theology, is not what someone is hearing me say. They have their own preconception. So we want to be very careful that way. But we also want to recognize that most of the debates going on between Calvinists and Arminians are very narrowly constrained to the issues and domain of soteriology. But the soteriological aspect of the debate between Calvinists and Arminians really is nothing more than a subset of the wider issues. There's a wider worldview. There's a wider theological, biblical system that you need to work through, of which soteriology is a very important part. But soteriology is not the only difference between a Calvinist view of God and an Arminian view of God. And so we don't want to just make it seem as if God's exactly the same and the world is exactly the same, except for this one little narrow issue. The differences are profound and vast. And so we don't want to get snookered into thinking that it's merely only about soteriology. It's much wider than that. The first category, then, a bit of a wider category, would be those who hold to what's called a libertarian view of free will. Libertarians. These are people classically, historically, who would hold to something called the liberty of indifference. Liberty being freedom, freedom of indifference. This position basically is that when someone comes to choose, if they have this liberty of indifference, they are not determined in their choice by any external factors or even any internal factors. That is, they are not determined to choose one way over the other, either by laws outside of them or even by their own internal makeup, mind, and character. What's interesting about this position is that if you truly have liberty of indifference, or if you understand free will in this way, you, by definition, are able to have a universe with exactly the same causal history. That is, if from this moment at this present time, everything that has happened in the past, it can be exactly the same. All of the natural laws are exactly the same. You are exactly who you are. I am exactly who I am. There is no relevant, there is not just relevant, there is no difference whatsoever in terms of quantity or quality, either external or internal to any of us. And yet, from this point, there can be two or multiple different futures. Causal history, reality, does not determine the future because of agents who have the ability, literally, with no matter who they are, no matter what laws are in place, they can choose one way or the other. There are two live options. The future, and this is will raise a bit of open theism, but this isn't merely open theism. It has a lot more to do with omniscience. They say that the future is literally open to possibility. From the exact same past, from this moment forward, there is more than one possible future. A lot of people would question whether such analysis is coherent. That is, whether that's possible. And even if it's coherent and possible, there are certainly a lot of people who would think that is highly, highly problematic. And we'll see reason why people make those sorts of objections in a moment. Libertarians, who have this view of liberty of indifference, are also a subset of a wider group, though, called indeterminists, or incompatibilists, rather. Incompatibilists. These are people who believe that free will is incompatible with any form of determinism. So libertarians are incompatibilists. Libertarians believe that to have genuine free will, you cannot have a universe which is deterministic. But they are not the only incompatibilists. There are people on the opposite end of the spectrum who endorse determinism. They're called hard determinists. That is, they believe that we really do live in a universe which is deterministic. And you will know this. If you pay careful attention to the news, if you pay careful attention to the media, if you read books, you will know there are all sorts of arguments today that all of what we see, including human behavior, is just determined by natural law. It's simply determined by the coordinates and natural laws and trajectory at the singularity moment of the Big Bang. That if you could just have an accurate enough understanding of mathematics and physics at the moment of the Big Bang, you could chart out the interactions of every particle in the history of the universe. You know, not everyone thinks this way. There are a lot of people who deal with quantum physics who are indeterminists and who would challenge that assessment. But nonetheless, there are lots of people who say that the universe is deterministic. And even if there is some quantum indeterminacy at a micro level, macro level systems, the universe at large, larger systems like human beings, like the human mind, are very regular and predictable. These larger macro systems do function with regularity and predictability. Why? Because they're determined to do so on the basis of natural law, on the basis of what they are. And so human behavior is nothing more than the outworking of these deterministic processes. Beyond that, at a narrower level, you'd have people who would argue for biological and genetic determinism, sort of zooming in smaller, in a smaller capacity, in a more narrow way to the human organism, that all of our behavior is determined by our genetic makeup, by our biology, the way that we have evolved. Others, of course, argue that we are determined sociologically. They'd argue that sociology is a science in its infant stages, and already we can have tremendous statistical probabilistic ideas or guesses as to how people are going to behave in any given society. That is, you can statistically begin to look at environmental factors as indicators for future behavior. They say, well, we don't know hardly anything about this yet, but the more we grow in understanding of psychology and sociology, the better we are at predicting future behavior in human beings. And the more we study, the more we can track back and identify causal forces and factors. Now, sociology, of course, if this is true, really again collapses back into naturalistic, materialistic determinism. Right, it's the determinism of natural law, just in its sociological manifestation. That is, if all we are the products of natural forces, then all society is the product of natural forces as well. So you can collapse all of these distinctions, or you can subsume all of these distinctions back under the wider umbrella of simply deterministic natural law. Hard determinists will say that if your genetics determine what you do, or if society determines what you do as a subset of wider natural law determinism, then there is no free will. So free will is incompatible with determinism. Determinism is true, therefore there is no such thing as genuine freedom and freedom of the will. Roughly, again, there is a third position known as compatibilism. And the vocabulary here is obvious. Compatibilists believe that some kinds of freedom are compatible with some kinds of determinism. They don't say that all definitions of freedom are compatible with all definitions of determinism, but some types of freedom really are compatible with some types of determinism. A lot of compatibilists say that the liberty of indifference certainly does not exist in our universe, and may not exist in any possible world, may not exist in any possible universe. It may not even be logically coherent. The compatibilist analysis of freedom, roughly and simply, is that an agent is free, human beings are free, when they do what they please, when they are not coerced, when they are not restrained, they are not compelled. When a human being does what he or she pleases, they act as a responsible and free agent. Well, those are just some of the introductory sketch of the positions. What are the issues that drive people into these various camps? Issue number one is the issue of alternative possibilities. Alternative possibilities. Roughly, in order for someone to really be able to choose options, between options, both options must be legitimately open. In the literature, this is often illustrated in terms of what's called the Garden of Forking Paths. You imagine that you go to a botanical garden or a horticultural field, and you go in acres and acres and acres of plants and all that sort of thing. You go in the front gate, and you walk down a broad path, and then you come to a fork in the road. Two paths branch off, one to the left, one to the right. Alternative pathways, the libertarians would say, if there's anything that determines which way you're going to go, then you're not really free. You have to, with the exact same causal history and with nothing compelling you externally or internally, you need to be able to come to that fork in the road and choose to turn left or choose to turn right. Both must actually be possible for you to do. Well, let's say in this day you go, and without any coercion, your liberty of indifference, you decide to turn left, and you turn left, and you go 100 yards in that direction, and you come to another fork in the road. And again, that option needs to be open. You really need to be able to go left or right. And so you go right this time, and you pop your antihistamines if you have allergies, or you do whatever you need to do to enjoy that kind of day. And you spend a few hours, and every choice you make at those forks in the road are critical moments where you really can go either way. You really can. Both options are open. But every option that you choose does foreclose others. That is, when you first go left, you are no longer free to go into this sector of the garden. So you're committed to one particular sequence once you make those decisions. Making those decisions open up new possibilities as surely as they close off other ones. But at the moment of decision, nothing determines which way you will go. This has often been something which resonates at a common sense level of intuition. We deliberate about choices, and we only think things through because we tend to believe that we actually have options open, that we really can go left or right. And so we think about these things, and we weigh what we would call live options, you know, trying to figure out which way that we should go. So when philosophers come along and say, well, you need alternative possibilities, you need alternate pathways through life in order to actually be free, this sort of resonates with us. But it's been challenged by a very interesting set of philosophical thought experiments. It originated, actually, with the philosopher John Locke centuries ago. Locke proposes this thought experiment. He says, imagine a man who falls asleep. And for those of you here in the afternoon listening to me talk, that might not be too difficult to imagine. Imagine a man who falls asleep. But this is what happens to the sleepers. Someone comes along and picks him up while he's sleeping, takes him into a room, throws him in it, locks the door, and leaves. The man is locked in. He cannot get out of the room if he wants to. He wakes up. He looks around. The room is beautifully furnished. Pleasant window. He has a beautiful view. And he decides, looking around, he doesn't try the door, he's not interested in leaving, he decides that he wants to stay. He wants to stay in the room. He can't leave if he wants to. So he doesn't have alternative possibilities. He can't choose between staying or going. But without knowing that he can't leave, without that being any consideration or factor in his decision-making process whatsoever, he decides he wants to stay. Locke says, does he decide to stay freely? If he decides to stay freely, then that is a strong intuition that you don't always need alternative possibilities to do something freely. You can be determined to do something. He is determined. It is determined for him that he will stay. And yet he stays freely if you share the intuition that the locked door has nothing whatsoever to do with the reasons and rationale and acceptance of his decision to stay. Now, this was an idea which sort of lay dormant for a lot of centuries until it was picked up with a vengeance in the 1970s by the philosopher Harry Frankfurt. And from the 1970s until today, all of these cases have now been labeled Frankfurt cases or Frankfurt-type cases. Frankfurt proposes, philosophers always do strange things. They always have strange thought experiments to try to help clarify ideas. Frankfurt posits a nefarious, evil neurosurgeon. And no offense to neurosurgeons or to doctors, but they always come out very badly in philosophical examples. You have this neurosurgeon named Black, of course, right? Obviously. And you have this poor subject named Jones. And Black places a neurological chip in Jones's brain that he can use to control Jones at moments that he so chooses. Frankfurt examples have been wildly updated, become more and more and more technical as time goes on, but here's probably the clearest example that's relevant for today. Jones usually seems to be going into a voting booth to vote in these examples. It's election day, and I am not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but let's say that it's the next U.S. presidential election, and it's come down between Barack Obama and Sarah Palin, right? Is that the way it's happening here? Or no, I'm not really following U.S. politics too much. So it's Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. Maybe that's more accurate, right? And so Jones goes in, and he really doesn't know who to vote for. He doesn't have any idea. Now, listen, I know that you know the right person to vote for, so just keep it to yourself. But Jones doesn't. Jones is not sure who he should vote for. So he goes into the voting booth, and as far as he's concerned, he really does have alternative possibilities. He might choose Obama. He might choose Romney. But Black, the philosophers usually miss this, but Black, because he is evil, wants him to vote Democrat. Right. Does that play well here? Is that the right crowd? I don't know my political crowds here. I'm just guessing. He wants him to vote Democrat, and so he monitors Jones, and he knows that whenever Jones wants to vote Republican, or when he's feeling favorable to the Republicans, he gets a little sweaty, or there's some sort of neurological sign that Black can monitor, and so Black has determined that when he sees that sign, when the monitor goes off that Jones is about to vote for Romney, he is going to activate the neurological implant, override that decision, and force Jones to vote for Obama. Jones does not have alternative possibilities. One thing is for sure, he's going into that booth, he's voting for Obama, and he's coming out of that booth. He goes in, Black is monitoring him, and Jones votes for Obama. Black never activates the neurological chip. There is never any sign to indicate that Jones is looking to vote Republican. And so the question is, does Jones, when Black and the neurological chip have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the decision, does Jones vote for Obama freely? If your intuition is that yes, he is free, because you could actually subtract the neurological chip, you could take it out of his brain, and you could destroy, and you could annihilate Black. That is, you could recast the scenario without them, because they don't contribute anything causal to the situation whatsoever. Jones would have behaved exactly the same way whether Black had never existed. And so if Jones is free, if Black never exists, and Black may as well not have existed, for all the causality he contributed to the event, then is Jones free? If your intuition is yes, then again, strong indicator that you do not need alternative possibilities in order to be free and in order to be responsible for what you do. Now, the libertarians have cried foul about this because remember, this is where it gets increasingly technical. Remember, the whole point about libertarianism is that the decision can go either way regardless of causal history, external or internal factors. And so they say before the moment of decision, if there's any sign which indicates which way the decision is going to go, you don't have true libertarianism. Because if that sign wasn't there, you'd have a different causal history. Right? Well, compatibilists are clever enough to get past that, and so the most recent one that I'm aware of, and is the best one by far, runs this way. A neurosurgeon, Black, wants to cause Bob to steal Anne's car. And so he puts a device in Bob's brain, which he will not monitor, but which will simply have a countdown timer, so that in 1 hour from implantation, Bob will steal Anne's car. There is no sign. There is nothing like that. There is no monitor. It's all mechanistic now. It's computerized. However, at the moment when the device is going to detonate, Bob freely smashes the car or the window of Anne's car, jumps in and drives away. The device causally does not go off because Bob decides to steal the car without the timer reaching its countdown mark. So there's no monitor. Causal history is identical. There's no pre-sign for another agent to be observing. Does Bob steal the car on his own? Is he responsible? Again, if you say yes, you're precluding the necessity of alternative possibilities for freedom. You can imagine if Bob is caught and goes to jail and says, well, listen, Your Honor, there was a neurological implant, which although it didn't go off, would have, and so I didn't have alternative possibilities. And so even though it didn't causally contribute to my stealing the vehicle at all, it would have, and therefore, on a libertarian sense, I'm not free or responsible. That's not likely to be a compelling argument. The intuition is that he was responsible, even though he didn't have alternative pathways. One of the big challenges, actually two alternative pathways, is called the rollback argument. One of the difficulties with it is that, and this is one of the criticisms of libertarian and free will in general, is that it seems to, far from giving us control, freedom, responsibility, what it actually does upon analysis is it seems to make us the pawns of chance and luck and fortune. The reason for this is, imagine it this way. You go into the garden of forking paths. You go left the first time, right the next time, left, and you spend 3 or 4 hours wandering around between 1 and 4, 3 hours in this garden. And you explore all these nooks and crannies over here. Then at 4 o'clock, God rolls back time to 1 o'clock, the moment when you enter the garden of forking paths. Do not forget, you need to always bear this in mind, libertarianism says to have liberty and a difference, you can make different choices with the exact same causal history, the exact same internal and external factors. So you go into the garden of forking paths this time, and this time you go right instead of left initially. Well, now for the rest of the afternoon, you have foreclosed all of these possibilities you experienced the first time, and you experience a completely different set of possibilities, 100% different. None of them are the same. God rolls back time to 1 o'clock. This time, you go left, you make the first 3 turns the same way as you did in time number one, then you go off differently. Let's say you do this, and you end up walking through the garden of forking paths 1,000 times. If you overlaid all the different routes that you took, you would probably literally cover almost every inch of the entire place, but never in the same way twice. Or maybe sometimes there would be overlapping depending on how many pathways there are, right? The idea then, though, is that it's just a matter of luck which pathways you actually end up experiencing. In fact, your actual afternoon, the one that counts, statistically, you may have taken a pathway that you would only take 3 times out of 1,000. Whereas there might have been another set of pathways that you would have taken 250 times out of 1,000. There's no control whatsoever. Now, the issue with luck then becomes this. Remember, the Garden of Forking Path is just an analogy, it's just an illustration. It's an example of life, of what it means to actually have decisions in your life, alternative pathways and possibilities in your life. So what that means is that there may very, very well be people who one time out of 1,000 would commit adultery. But that's simply the one actual time of their life. 950 times out of 1,000, they wouldn't have become alcoholics. But the one that actually counts is the time when they made that one bad decision. Statistically, the majority of time, they would have gone right instead of left. That time, they just happened to go left instead of right, and it ushers in to disaster. There are a lot of people on Arminian grounds who, if God just rolled back time sufficiently, maybe twice, maybe three times, maybe four times, maybe 100 times, if he just rolled back history enough times, one of the times through the Garden of Forking Paths, they'd accept Jesus. But the actual time that they live their life, the one that counts, they don't. It's just dumb luck. There's nothing in me, there's nothing outside of me which determines which way I go. And so what you do is you just hope that your one trip through, the one that counts, you just get really, really, really lucky. That you just hit all the right turns and all the right twists at just the right time. Because frankly, if God rolled it back, there's a very, very good chance you'd do it worse. If God rolled it back, there's a very, very good chance you'd do it better. There's no controls whatsoever. Perhaps, and you should be very thankful for this. This is one of the statistically anomalous times. You should be thankful this is the actual one. Because maybe 999 times out of 1,000, you wouldn't be here listening to me. And wouldn't that just be a shame? Just hard to imagine. Hard to imagine. Well, it's these sorts of considerations, too, about alternative possibilities, which raises issue number two, which is the issue of God's foreknowledge. Now, there are an awful lot more things at stake than just alternative possibilities and libertarianism in terms of God's knowledge. What does foreknowledge mean? And you have all those linguistic and exegetical and theological debates. But in the history of philosophy and theology, there has been a long-ranging discussion, which a lot of people find somewhat silly today, but which has been taken very, very seriously, and is still taken very seriously in some circles. And the idea is simply this. If God knows the future, then God knows what I will do in the future. And if God knows what I will do in the future, then I must do that thing which he knows I will do. And so at the moment, I can't do anything else. I cannot do anything except that which God knows I will do. And if I can't do anything different, then I don't have what? I don't have alternative possibilities. If I don't have alternative possibilities, I don't have libertarian freedom. So if God knows tonight after supper that I will have dessert, and let me just say that I basically know that I will have dessert, so that's not that much of a feat. But if God knows it, it's for sure, you know, that I absolutely will. And the issue and the question then is, if God has a belief that tonight I will have dessert, can I act in such a way as to render his belief false? That is, if an omniscient being has a belief, if we're even comfortable using that sort of language about God's knowledge. But if an omniscient God has a belief about what I will do, can I act so as to render that belief false? And it wouldn't seem that I can, or else you have a lot of problems when it comes to defining what omniscience happens to be. So if that's the case then, though, if God knows what I will do in the future, then God holds that belief now. And God holds his belief about my dessert eating or not eating later, future for me, 300 years ago, or at the moment of creation, or in eternity past. And so God's belief about my future is a fact about the past. God now factually knows what I will do in the future. And so I can't act in such a way as to change a fact about God and a fact about the present. In the same way that I cannot act in any way to undo the Vietnam War, or to change what anything happened, or what any of us did, even 1 second ago. None of us can act to change anything in the past. That's a sort of accepted intuition, that we can't change anything in the past. But if God's beliefs about our future are in the past, and we can't change anything in the past, then how can we change any of his beliefs which are in the past? Well, it doesn't seem that we can. And so then it doesn't seem that we can genuinely have alternative possibilities for the future. Now, this has raised a horrible discussion about a difference between what are called hard and soft facts about the past. A hard fact is something which has actually happened. A soft fact is a fact which is a belief fact in the past, but it's still tied to what will happen in the future. It's a discussion we won't bother having. It's a belief in the past, it's a fact, but predicated on a future event. So people try to get a lot of mileage, you know, out of this. And the argument is that God's beliefs in the past, the soft facts, would be different if I acted differently in the future. Right? So some people will say, well, God knows that I'll have dessert tonight because I will. But if I didn't have dessert tonight, then God would know that I won't. What's interesting about this is that it actually commits us to a position of backward temporal causation. That is, the effect comes prior to the cause. We say what I do in the future is the cause of God's knowledge. So my act is the cause, God's knowledge is the effect, and the effect is now, the cause is in the future. So to maintain that, you actually have to argue for backward temporal causation, which some people are happy to. It has a whole lot to do with how you view time and all the rest. You know, there's an A theory of time, a B theory of time. Some people want to say that time is just like directions. You know, we talk about past, present, and future, but what we really mean is relative in general, like left or right. You know, what does it mean to be left from something? Well, it depends where you are on the map. You know, some people want to see it like an unfolding stream. Time's all very, very complicated. You know, Augustine said that he knows what time is by experience, and he knows what time is until someone asks him to explain it. And then he doesn't have any idea. These issues of soft facts have really raised two complicated issues between epistemology and metaphysics. That is, how does God know what he knows in relationship to what is? There are three, excluding open theism, there are three main positions historically in the church. And by the way, if you think that this whole discussion about what I'll have for dessert and backward causation is all a bunch of nonsense and not relevant whatsoever, it is those considerations which were a major driving impetus behind Clark Pinnock's acceptance of open theism. Pinnock is for always saying, if God knows the future, there's no alternative possibilities, and we don't have libertarian free will, so God can't know the future. Which, of course, we get from the Bible, not from our philosophy, right? It's all of you classical guys who have imbibed Greek philosophy. Shame on you, you know, and all the rest. While he's endorsing, you know, Charles Hartshorne and process theology and philosophy and all that sort of thing. A little bit like the pot calling the kettle black in terms of smuggling philosophical assumptions in. But this whole idea of the future, God's foreknowledge in relationship to what I can do, is actually a major stumbling block for some of these open theists. This is a major issue for them. And so it's one that we want to be aware of. Classical Arminian position, libertarian position, when you don't go into open theism, is that God has what's called simple foreknowledge. God simply knows the future ahead of time. This is often cast in terms of his eternal and epistemic vantage points. That is, God just sees all of history because he stands outside of the time stream. He sees the beginning of time. He sees the end of time. The analogy, which you are probably familiar with, most commonly used, is that God is sort of like someone standing up on a mountain, looking down in the distance at a road. All the travelers on the road can't see around the bends. They have limited visibility. You know, the road rolls up and down, and so you lose your horizon marks. And so everyone on the road can only see a limited distance. But the one up on the mountain can see the whole road at one shot. And so this is God. You know, God's up there on the mountain. And he sees all of time unfold in a way which is different from us. So God knows what's going to happen in the future because he sees it. In terms of soteriology, foreknowledge, right? God looks into the future, sees the people who will receive Jesus with their own free will, and on that basis elects them. You know, on that basis includes them in Jesus Christ. On that basis predestines them for glory and being conformed into the image of Jesus. God knows because he just sees into the future in an eternal present. Now, this sounds good. And this is miles better than open theism. Miles. And to be honest, I think that we need to, maybe just me, but sometimes as reform types, we need to be a little bit more quick to give credit where credit is due in the evangelical world. And where people at least acknowledge that God knows everything, including everything in the future, they might not understand foreknowledge, but that's not the worst position there is in the world. So that's at least something, you know, that God knows the future. But there are actually several stings in the tail in this position of simple foreknowledge. The one that undergirds all of them is that this makes God's knowledge of the future reactionary to reality. That is, God knows because he sees. God's knowledge is based on what happens. Reality is the cause of God's knowledge. So God's knowledge becomes an effect. God's knowledge is reactionary to reality. He simply sees what is. Now, that would be almost all right if push came to shove. But what it does, though, is there's certain entailments now. If God's knowledge is reactionary to reality, then what it actually does in a very unique way is it reduces God to being a helpless bystander, watching history unfold. Well, why? Because God sees what is. All he does is he sees what is. He sees reality. But if he sees what is, if he sees reality, he cannot do anything to change what he sees. Why? If God knew that at 6 o'clock tonight I was going to walk out the doors and get run over by a truck, if God sees that as part of the unfolding of space-time history, if God sees that as an event of the future, it is going to happen. Why? God saw it. If it wasn't going to happen, God wouldn't have seen me get hit by a truck at 6 o'clock tonight. There wouldn't have been that event for him to see, right? So I pray for safety. Lord, all things being equal, after my dessert, I'd prefer not to get hit by a truck tonight. Please keep me safe. Well, what can God do? His knowledge of reality is reactionary to what is. He already knows I'm going to eat dessert and get hit by a truck. Those things are facts. And if God sees them, then they will happen. Because if God was going to do something to intervene and help, he wouldn't have seen those things in the first place. So this whole Arminian idea that God interacts in history because he sees the consequences, he sees the disaster, so then he comes riding in and changes things, is completely contradictory to their view of how God knows what's going to happen in the future in the first place. Because if God sees it and his knowledge is reactionary to reality, then God sees what is and he can't change what is or he wouldn't see it. So you lose one of these warm and fuzzy relational things where God just sees all the mistakes and comes in and helps me out and changes life and changes the history and alters the causality. He can't, because he just sees what is. He doesn't control it. The other thing then is that this really undercuts one of the strongest Arminian points, which is the necessity and vitality of prayer. Why pray to God? Why? What does it mean that prayer changes things? Well, on an Arminian view of foreknowledge, the one thing it doesn't mean is that it changes anything. It can't change anything because God has already seen what's going to happen. So God sees that two people are going to get married, and remember, you know, systematically, you know, hold all of your principles together, all of your libertarian principles together, so that God sees two wonderful, godly Christians on fire for the Lord, serving Him. They fall in love. They're compatible. It's a beautiful thing, and they both pray, Lord, we want what's best for you. We want to serve you all of our lives. Help us, guide us, help us to know if we should get married. God, seeing the end from the beginning, He sees that this girl, bad luck, one in a million times through the Garden of Forking Pathways. There are going to be some events which, instead of drawing her close to the Lord, make her embittered. She's going to suffer a loss of a loved one. Instead of growing closer to God and His strength, she's going to recoil from God, question Him, doubt Him, make a bad choice at just a vulnerable time. Talk about luck, that's all it is. One wrong choice at just a vulnerable time. She ends up in a totally different sector of life with the garden, where she pulls back from spiritual disciplines, where she no longer seeks fellowship and comfort of believers and the Word of God and worship. And remember, maintain all of your libertarian principles systematically. She loses her salvation. She loses her salvation without the restraining influence of the Holy Spirit. She becomes a postmodern relativist in terms of morality, has a series of adulterous affairs which ruins her, and as her husband watches her declension, believes that God could never allow such a thing to happen, and in his pain loses his salvation too. Both end up in hell. God hears their prayers. God, help us. Guide us. Should we be married? What can God do? He sees the end from the beginning. His knowledge is reactionary to reality. He already knows what's going to happen 30 years after their wedding day. And because His knowledge is reactionary, there's nothing He can do to intervene to change it. If He did, He wouldn't have seen what He saw in the first place. The whole causal history would be altered. This also commits you actually to, we don't have time to get into this, it also commits you to a perhaps semi-problematic view where God, from eternity, in His eternal vantage point, discovers what He's going to do in temporal time and space, right? Because as He interacts with His creatures, He's standing up on the mountain, just looking down, and He discovers how He acts in time. Because His libertarian agents are making decisions, which He couldn't know unless He saw the whole time stream. He sees what they do, then He sees how He counters that. Oh, that's great. I didn't know I was going to do that. Now, the issue, though, is that when He does that, it's entirely possible that He errs. So He sees that in time and space, it seemed like a great thing to send a flood in Noah's day. But He also sees 5,000 years later, this event is going to be held up as such a moral monstrosity that far more people with their libertarian free will reject the gospel than they would have if He had treated the world more leniently in Noah's day. But what can He do? He's discovering how He acts and reacts to His agents in time and space through His eternal vantage point. And since His knowledge is reactionary to reality, there's nothing He can do to intervene. If He did, you'd have a whole different causal history. A whole different causal history, you'd have a whole different set of things to see. Now, let me hasten to add that the whole idea of time and God's relationship to it is something I don't have the faintest idea. So don't ask a question about, well, how does God relate to time? I don't know. Okay, and so I'm glad that you do. Position number two. In terms of God's foreknowledge and relationship to time. Middle knowledge. Not so often sort of captured or endorsed in its actual system, but some of these ideas are very prominent in certain evangelical circles. Middle knowledge comes from the philosopher Luis de Molina, a Spanish philosopher centuries ago. And he argues that God, he tries to provide a middle position where God knows the future and creatures act freely. Because God knows the future because He knows what every creature will do with their free will in any set of circumstances. And so this is how God both controls the future and isn't responsible for sin, isn't responsible for people rejecting the gospel and all those sorts of things. It's sort of a middle position. God knows every possible world, and he actualizes the one where people act freely, and he knows what they're going to do, you know, with their libertarian free will. This is the way it's usually cast in evangelicalism today. The great issue with this, from the jump, though, is that if you think God knows what libertarian agents will do in any given set of circumstances, you don't have libertarianism. Because libertarianism is the position that, given the exact same set of circumstances, you don't know what the agent will do. So to say, well, God actualizes the conditions, then he knows what the agent will do, is to deny libertarianism exactly immediately. Far from supporting it. It actually presupposes a form of determinism, that the agent will do this in these circumstances. That's not libertarianism at all. Another problem with this, though, is sometimes called, there's two objections. One is the objection of confused causal knowledge. That is, God creates the world. We'll call it world one. He decides this is the world that he wants to create. And he knows, given those circumstances, what the creature will do in moment two, or time two, of world one. Creates world one, that's time one. The next moment is time two. So he creates world one, and apparently because he created world one, he knows exactly what the sequence of events will be in time two. But given libertarianism, again, given this idea of free will, you don't know what the free agent will do until they do it. So, Garden of Forking Pathways, you have God creates world one. The decisions made at time one can create time two, A, or time two, B, depending if you go left or if you go right. The idea is that God is supposed to know what time two will bring on the basis of instantiating the conditions of time one. But God can't know that he's actually created world one until he sees what happens at time two. Because he doesn't know which way the libertarian agents are going to choose until they actually do. So God can't know at the initial creation or actualization of these conditions which world he has actually created until he sees the next moment of that world. So until he sees time two, he doesn't really know what he's created at time one. But the whole argument of middle knowledge that he knows what's going to happen at time two because of the conditions of time one, but he doesn't know that it is time one until he sees time two. So which is it? You have this reversed causal order where God's knowledge of time two is contingent. It's founded or grounded in his knowledge of time one. But he only knows what's happening at time one. He only knows what world one is if he sees world two. My goodness, right? You don't know which world he is actually created. But what's more important than that is what's called the grounding objection. And this is that if God doesn't know what the agent will do on the basis of his own character, that is, God's own character, and he can't know what the agent will do on the basis of his libertarian character, then God's supposed knowledge of what the agent will do isn't grounded in anything. It's not grounded in his character. It's not grounded in the libertarian agent's character. And so God's knowledge of what these creatures will actually do in those circumstances is literally groundless. There's no foundation for it whatsoever. The third position, the Calvinistic position historically, that God knows the future because he's decreed the future. In this model, God knows the future because it's the outworking of his wise plan. God doesn't know what's going to happen in the future because he is reactionary to it. God doesn't know what is going to happen in the future because he just happens to have a different epistemic, ontological vantage point where he sees it. God knows what's going to happen in the future because he decrees it. In that sense, time and space and all of history is the sequential unfolding of God's plan, which previously is in his own mind. And it's in his own mind because it flows out of his own character. And so in this model, the model of knowledge by decree, God's knowledge of the future is not ad extra outside of himself or contingent or dependent on any factors he epistemically discovers. Rather, all of history, all of the space-time universe is what it is because it's contained in his infinitely wise plan and flows out of his character. Far from God's knowledge being contingent or reactionary to reality, reality, our history, is contingent and reactionary to the character and mind and purpose and plan of Almighty God. With that, we'll take a break.